You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Well, folks, it's been a hell of a year. Or maybe I should say it's been a year of hell. 2020 introduced us to COVID-19, quarantine life, and extreme economic uncertainty, but it also bore witness to an impeachment trial, Brexit, police violence against black Americans, China's crackdown on peaceful protests in Hong Kong, post-apocalyptic wildfires, murder hornets, 5G conspiracy theories, the cancellation of the Summer Olympics, a massive Russian hack of the U.S. government, way too many celebrity podcasts, and way too much banana bread, and 365 more excruciating days of the Trump presidency. On the upside, the election hopefully put an end to said presidency once and for all. Harvey Weinstein went to prison, and we got a new season of The Crown. Still, I think we can all agree that this has been just about the shittiest year in recent memory, and we're all looking for a little closure. Here to help is a brand new comedy special from Amazon Prime Video that will give 2020 the send-off it deserves with an all-star lineup of female comedians who eulogize the things we lost this year. Yearly Departed is available on Amazon starting December 30th, and today I'm joined by the show's writer and executive producer, Bess Kalb, who talks about her own trials and tribulations over the past year, including a recent COVID scare at the pediatrician, how she finds catharsis through laughter, and how that inspired her to bid adieu to 2020 with a rollicking roast-style memorial service. She reveals some of the comedians that she attracted to this special, some of the things they sarcastically eulogize, and how they managed to orchestrate an entirely socially distanced production that doesn't look like it on the screen. Bess shares stories from her 8 years as a comedy writer on Jimmy Kimmel Live, including being the interviewer for Jimmy's Lie Witness News segments and coming up with the classic Baby Bachelor sketch. Plus, she talks about writing jokes for Hillary Clinton, working as an undercover speechwriter at the Democratic National Convention, and perhaps her proudest moment, getting blocked by Donald Trump on Twitter. Coming up with Bess Kalb in just a moment. Bess Kalb is an Emmy Award-nominated comedy writer and best-selling author of Nobody Will Tell You This But Me. She wrote for 8 years on Jimmy Kimmel Live and was a regular Man on the Streets correspondent for Kimmel's Lie Witness News segment before leaving the show to adapt her book into a movie. She received a WGA Award in 2016, wrote for the Emmy Awards telecast in 2012 and 2016, and for the Academy Awards in 2017 and 2018. She has written jokes for Hillary Clinton and wrote speeches for the 2020 Democratic National Convention. Now she's head writer and executive producer of a new comedy special that features an all-star cast of women comedians bidding a not-so-fond farewell to 2020 and delivering eulogies for all the things we've lost this year, from casual sex to beige Band-Aids. Yearly Departed comes out on Amazon December 30th. Bess Kalb, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ben. What a great introduction.
I try.
You did well.
Well, you know, Bess, I hate to start on a serious note, but I do follow you on Twitter, and I saw that you had a bit of a scare when you took your son to the pediatrician the other day. Can you talk about that? How are you?
Yeah, thank you. I am fine. We are all fine. If there's one thing that I could, when you have a 15-month-old, there's a scare every week. There's like a catastrophic thing every week. The reason that I shared what I shared is masks saved our lives, potentially. You know, masks are, we had a COVID scare, and the reason that my husband, baby, and I don't have COVID is that our pediatrician, who was unknowingly an asymptomatic carrier, she was wearing an N95. And so we were completely fine, even though my unmasked baby, who unfortunately is MAGA, as I said on Twitter, it's our only explanation. He was not wearing a mask. Obviously, he's 15 months old, and politically doesn't agree with it. But the he was incredibly vulnerable in that situation. But he's safe because masks save lives. And that if there is one thing that I can put out there on that. That time suck and a nightmare occasionally of an app, it's hopefully making people make smart decisions to keep each other safe.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife and I have a 10-month-old daughter who was born just before COVID. And so we're going through the same thing. Those pediatrician visits, they're absolutely terrifying, but especially because those rooms are so damn small.
So small. God. It's harrowing. And you just sort of have to, you have to just suspend every instinct that you've cultivated during a pandemic and just sort of be like, why take my baby and look in his ear? Get right up there, stranger. Yeah. But our pediatrician is wonderful, and thank goodness, you know, follows safety protocols the way she does. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's good. You know, I don't know about you, but in a way, I kind of feel like the quarantine has been weirdly equalizing because, as I mentioned, we just had our baby literally a couple of weeks before everything shut down.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, in normal times, me and my wife would both be whining about having no life and not being able to have a date night or spend time with friends. But that's pretty much everyone right now. So for us, it really doesn't feel like we're missing out on anything at all.
It's so great to talk to another newish parent about this because quarantine started right after my maternity leave ended. So like my wardrobe didn't change. I was just sort of like feeding around the house. And, you know, my life, you know, people, I saw people sort of like lamenting the loss of social life and this, like this crazy fun party world. And my husband and I just sat there and we were like, well, we're on season 5 of The Good Wife. And I guess we'll just soldier on all the way through. And that's exactly what we did. And
yeah, I love what you said about being able to extend your pregnancy wardrobe a little longer thanks to the quarantine.
Oh, yeah. People were buying sweatpants. I was like, I've got this. I've got this covered. There's nothing in this wardrobe that is not elastic.
Yeah. Now, is this your first child?
Yes.
Wow. That's an experience. Yes, our first. And I don't know if you can see this, but my eyeglasses are currently glued together right now because our daughter Charlotte ripped them off of my head and somehow managed to break them in the one place that's completely impossible to repair. So,
perfect.
You know, and of course, Daddy doesn't understand super glue. So I spent a good couple of hours yesterday with them physically attached to my head, which I suppose is one way to keep her from ripping them off again.
that's the solution to two problems, right? Right there.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned earlier that you're a great follower on Twitter, and apparently you have this honor of having been blocked by President Donald Trump, right? Yeah. Isn't it just nuts that the President of the United States, you know, has time to read your tweets, get pissed off about them, and then block you?
It's embarrassing for him that happened. You know, it is crazy to have been blocked by the former owner of the now bankrupt Taj Hotel and Casino, you know, somebody who failed to sell so many steaks and who was, I guess, the chancellor of a fraudulent university. What a sort of notch in my belt to be blocked by him. It's horrible that he would spend any time on Twitter that wasn't like a pre-prepared, you know, social media vetted way to communicate with the public using this, you know, app that's slightly beneath it. Like a president communicating on Twitter should be like should just be, it's sort of like your school principal making an announcement over the PA. You're not there to rant. It should be a formal thing. And he you know, used it to tell a comedy writer to shut up. And I did. It worked. Yeah. I respected him and changed my mind.
I love it. And I love that you gave a shout out to the bankrupt Taj Casino, because I kind of feel like now his spin would be, because all the casinos are going bankrupt, he's like, well, I went bankrupt before it was popular. I was ahead of the curve on this.
Oh, he is a trendsetter. We'll give him that.
I'm curious. Do you know which tweet got you blocked?
I should know that. I don't. I know that at the time I was channeling my frustration with his tweets, and not just with him, but the fact that he would take to social media like a 14-year-old to sort of like vent about, you know, how misunderstood he was. And I which is honestly something that I said that is really offensive to the 14-year-old community. I think I was replying to his tweets in this sort of condescending, in this extremely condescending way, like as a maternal figure saying like, you're spiraling clearly, you know, I think, honey, just take a step back and you'll feel better about this tomorrow. Like I was trying to give him what I honestly thought he needed. So they were actually nice. Like, let the record show they were nice things. It's not like I was calling him the orange monster or whatever. You know, I wasn't one of those. I was actually saying nice things, but he couldn't, I think he read between the lines and after one of them just blocked me.
Yeah. Some people are just immune to help. What can you do?
I know. He can't help himself. I'm just one woman.
Yeah. And I understand that your tweets were actually what got you hired for Jimmy Kimmel Live. Is that right?
I'd like to think my packet was, but
initially got the attention.
It's sort of a long story short. Yeah. I became a comedy writer because I started writing jokes on Twitter, and I was lucky enough to be retweeted by a bunch of comedians whom I didn't know, but who liked my jokes. And so I was a fact checker at Wired Magazine in San Francisco, who was like quietly writing tweets on the side to my friends, to like, you know, like here I am with my little cultural commentary, you know, for like the people I would see for beer later that night, to be like, nice one. And that was the extent of it. And then, you know, all of a sudden I had all of these Letterman and SNL people and Family Guy writers following me and like engaging with me on this website. And it felt very surreal. And there were also some great comedians like Rob Delaney and Kelly Oxford, who at the time were extremely supportive of my jokes and my tweets. And I think it was one that Rob or Kelly retweeted. It is due to both of them that my incredible boss, Jimmy Kimmel, ended up, I think, becoming aware of my tweets. But it was because I wrote jokes on Twitter that the sort of comedians who became my mentors took notice and eventually let me know that the show Jimmy Kimmel Live was looking to hire a writer. And one writer on Twitter actually DM'd me to submit a packet through her agent. And so I was, you know, there I was in San Francisco doing this, and because other people were encouraging me to do it, and other women specifically. So very grateful to them. Nell Scovell is the writer who was the one who did that. And I wrote a packet and submitted it, and my bosses, Molly McNerney and Carrie Greenberg and Jimmy Kimmel, liked the packet and gave me a 13-week trial period. And then eight years later, I was still there in my trial period.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because I always think of late night as being a very masculine environment to be in. But, you know, I've heard that that show has a lot of sharp women who are really the ones who run the show, right?
They are. Women run that show. Like full stop. When I was there, the show's executive producers and one of the head writers were women. Jill Lederman, Aaron Irwin, Jen Sharon, and Molly McNerney were all executive producers of that show. And, you know, there was a man in front of the camera, but there were certainly women were the ones behind it who were making it happen.
Like I said, in my mind, I have these fantasies of what it must be like to be a writer for a late night show that are probably straight out of my favorite year. But I can't imagine what it must be like when you have just hours to come up with a whole new hour long show 5 nights a week. Is it pretty high pressured environment?
Well, it's only a 20 or so minute monologue.
Oh, right. Okay.
So the rest is on the host and the guests. But the it looks like this. It's just sort of like a person behind her laptop trying her best. You're just like, it's a job that you do. Mm-hmm. It's not all around a table. You really do it alone, do your assignments and come together in the office but it was certainly, the most fun I have ever had at a job in my life. And I'm really? So sad to have left, and in talking about it, get very wistful and regret it. But my dearest friends in my life are friends that I made at that show. And I'm mm-hmm. so grateful for it.
What is it like when you're in that writer's room? I mean, I always hear these stories of how cutthroat it can be in the writer's room. Do you get roasted pretty hard when you pitch a joke and it bombs?
Yeah. There were a lot of actual knifings, and, there was occasional bloodshed, mortal wounds a few times, and we honor those who passed. But overall it was pretty nonviolent.
Do you talk to those writers? I can't imagine what it's like trying to recreate the environment of a writer's room socially distanced now.
Well, I'm not, I gave my notice 2 days before lockdown happened. Mm. And so my goodbye party was over Zoom, and I don't know what a late night show is like over Zoom or socially distanced, but
yeah, I kind
of
wonder.
It was very fun to be in the room with all of those people in our clip room, and I will miss it so much. I will probably go back with like a baby Bjorn on and be like, "Hey guys, Biden, right?"
Now, what was your favorite sketch that you wrote for that? Do you have a favorite?
My favorite sketch, probably The Baby Bachelor.
Oh, yeah. You did that one. I love that.
Yeah, it was me, and it was directed by John Kimmel, who's a brilliant writer and director, mm-hmm. And starring his son, Wesley Kimmel. And that was my favorite. I will say it was the most horrible talent I've ever worked with. A group of 10 3-year-olds were impossible. They were divas. They needed snacks. Two of them cried like minute two.
It's literally like The Real Bachelor.
That's right. But aside from how impossible it was to work with these nightmare actors who should never work again, except for Wesley, who was absolutely perfect. And remains perfect. Yeah, I would say aside from the horrible experience with 3-year-olds as my colleagues, The Baby Bachelor is the most fun I've had. We also did The Baby Bachelorette, and we filmed for a day in Malibu. It was all very exciting and fun. I had a lot of fun. I was a preschool teacher and comedy writer all in one for that. So it's actually my exact dream scenario.
And you also did a lot of those man on the streets bits, right? Did you ever have days where you went out there and I don't know, it was just like pulling teeth? You felt like you came back to the studio empty handed?
No, I mean, I would never know on those shoots. I mean, the crew on those shoots and directors on those shoots were the hardest working people that I have ever had the like privilege to work with. That, I would always be like, "We don't have anything." And they would be like, "No, we have it." I would always be like, "Let's shoot more." Unless I was doing someone, I was like 7 months pregnant, and I was like, "I don't know if we have it." And they were like, "Sit down, we're going in." But the I think those were a really fascinating glimpse into a wide cross section of America. We shot on Hollywood and Highland, which is the Times Square of LA. It is a huge tourist destination. It's the Walk of Fame, and the Disney store is right there. So there are people from all over the world who come, and you get this crazy and exciting melting pot to like take an international temperature about a certain topic. Mm-hmm. And it was really just a sort of sociological experiment over the course of 8 years to talk to so many people who just so willingly made fools of themselves on camera. But no, mostly I think it was an experiment that showed when a camera is on you, you can trick yourself into believing anything, even what you're saying, if in your heart you know it isn't true. So who knows, maybe maybe it made people laugh, and I'm glad to provide that entertainment as just the like faceless correspondent with holding the microphone. But if it also made people understand something about Americans and about people's tendency to lie, then that's good too. And I wasn't the only one doing those. All of the writers did Live Witness News and were so brilliant at it. And
But I think you're right. I think it does kind of say something about where we are as a culture right now, and particularly a certain segment of the society that kind of will go along with anything if someone with some modicum of authority states it to them.
It's absolutely an experiment that proves that, you know, I'm not somebody who like was wearing a suit, or I would often just be there in like jeans and a flannel and my sneakers. I looked like a comedy writer, but you know, I wasn't like Jake Tapper interviewing people, but right. I think it was the camera and the microphone in their face. Who knows? Yeah. I was glad to be able to deliver about 2.5 minutes of comedy when the monologue, you know, if like that was what my job was in that day's monologue. So, but looking back on it, yeah, people are dumb.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. You also wrote Hillary Clinton's jokes for the Al Smith dinner, I think during the 2016 election. Speaking of politics, I mean, what a weirdly anachronistic evening that has to be. I mean, it's named after a New York politician from the roaring 20s that no one has ever heard of now. And, you know, it's all these old white guys all dressed up in white tie and tails doing like a Friars Club roast. Did you actually get to attend the event? What is that like?
No, if you've comedy writers don't get to go anywhere. No. You're lucky if you sort of. And that was something I did as a volunteer too. You're lucky if you get paid. comedy writers are like occasionally sent a link to watch or remote. We are the lowest of the low. I also was just on a team that wrote jokes for Secretary Clinton. I was not the only one who wrote them. And my joke was about Twitter. It was about Trump on Twitter. The one that I'm most proud of that she said. I mean, it is also an event for Catholic charities. That's what the Al Smith dinner is. So the Archdiocese of New York is there and members of the clergy. And so it's one of those old vestiges of old New York. And so much of American politics is ingrained in old vestiges of strange white men's ideas of how authority is conferred. The Electoral College is an example of that. Yeah. We are living in the sort of a colonially designed system and doing our best with the 350 million populace of people with varying degrees of need. And so the Al Smith dinner is just one example of the many ways that tradition exists in politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have to imagine that's sort of a tough environment for Hillary to walk into this, like I said, room full of old white men dressed up in white tie and tails. But luckily, she had a sense of humor. Trump, on the other hand, has no sense of humor.
That's her whole life. I have a feeling Hillary Clinton is very used to commanding a room that is just full of men in black tie, white tie. That's the game that she has mastered and something that she is so good at doing since she was in law school. So she's used to being the only woman in the room. And I'm glad that there are people like her who, you know, stand in that room so well and deliver what needs to be said so well.
And I think I remember that night because it was so bizarre. Trump, he had no comedic timing whatsoever and no sense of humor about himself. And he was just nasty and like mean, saying these horrible things that really weren't even jokes. They were insults, which totally goes against the whole point of that evening, I think, from what I recall.
Yeah, he bombed.
Now, I understand that you also wrote jokes for the Democratic National Convention this year. What a surreal experience that must have been. Who did you write for at the DNC?
I'm under a contract. I didn't write jokes. I wrote speeches.
You wrote full speeches?
Yeah.
And, no kidding.
NDAs are signed.
But
it was an honor of a lifetime to be entrusted with that kind of material. And I'm so grateful to have been a part of that incredible team.
Interesting.
But you know, for that, I am not the story. The speakers are the story.
So. Oh, that's interesting. They have you signing NDAs as to
everyone
who you wrote speeches for. Okay. That's weird. I always thought that kind of that was known, who writes speeches for everyone. That's
maybe, after
I mean, who
fact.
Doesn't want credit?
You know? You really do not know what it's like to be a writer. If you want credit, then find another line of work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like Dustin Hoffman at the end of Wag the Dog. It's like, I don't want the money. I want the credit.
Totally. But I think in my case, I just want a like cool merch.
Yeah.
I want a t-shirt.
Yeah. There you go.
Which I got. I would have liked
to have seen you write jokes for Don Jr.'s girlfriend when she gave her screed at the RNC.
She was really funny on her own.
I mean, she was like a screaming banshee in a giant room by herself, which is also how I imagine Trump most nights.
True. I thought she was hilarious. No notes.
Who can beat that? Yeah. Now, before we get to the special, I also want to mention you have this marvelous book that came out earlier in this year titled Nobody Will Tell You This But Me, A True As Told to Me Story. You wrote a memoir of sorts, but not from your perspective, rather in the voice of your grandmother, who is now deceased. How did you come up with that angle?
I came up with that angle during one of the darkest periods of my life, when I was like grieving the loss of the woman who raised me. And I missed her. And so in order to feel her presence again, somebody who I spoke with every day had died. I wrote as her talking to me. And so it was this grieving exercise that I did that turns out resonated with a lot of people who had similar experiences.
Yeah, I understand that a lot of people were really moved by this book. What was your grandmother? I think her name was Bobby like. Was she a funny lady?
She was. She was one of the funniest ladies I knew.
Yeah. Is that where you get it from?
Definitely. Anything good about me, I got from my grandmother, and everything bad about me, I got from my mother. That's what every woman will say. No, everything good about me, I got from my mother too. I love my mother.
Oh, okay. Okay. But you do talk about how the granddaughter grandmother relationship, you know, has the love that sometimes is missing between the mother and the daughter.
That's a Freudian slip if there ever was one.
Okay. Well, Bess, and now you've gone from this book, which was a eulogy to your grandmother, to eulogizing the year 2020 in this new comedy special, Yearly Departed. I also once read a great piece that you wrote in The New Yorker that was titled Obituaries My Mother Wrote For Me While I Was Living in San Francisco in My 20s.
Yes.
So it seems like you really have a thing for funerals. What's that about, Bess?
I just think they're funny. No, because like all comedians, I think comedy is born from tragedy.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess if there's one thing that, you know, I am also scared of death. And so joking about it is my way to cope with that.
Yeah. Now, you serve as head writer and executive producer of Yearly Departed. How did the idea for Yearly Departed come about?
You know, this year has been nightmarish for everybody in varying ways. And, you know, as somebody whose only way to deal with trauma and fear and anxiety and loss is to joke about it, as you now know, and as was well documented by my career, there seemed to be a place for catharsis through laughing about this year. Mm-hmm. And I fortunately was able to pull together a team of incredible writers for this show. My friends, Akilah Green, Jocelyn Richard, Karen Chi, and Francesca Ramsey. And we basically made each other laugh about the year. And about what we had lost and what we were saying goodbye to and how our lives had changed. And that ended up being group therapy and a comedy special that when all of these incredible comedians who are in it, Sarah Silverman, Natasha Leggero, Natasha Rothwell, Z-Way, Patty Harrison, who's incredible, and Phoebe Robinson, our host. Am I forgetting anybody? Tiffany Haddish.
Oh, yeah. How could you forget Tiffany?
Tiffany, and the most famous person in the world. when all of these people, I still can't believe that we did a comedy special with Tiffany Haddish and Sarah Silver. Like, it's crazy. Yeah. But that when these people read it, they were like, yes, that is how we process the year too. That is how we want to make ourselves feel better and make other people feel better about it. And so like, let's make this material into a show. Let's do it. And our incredible executive producers, Rachel Brosnahan and Paige Simpson, brought it to Amazon. And Amazon Studios has, you know, as you know, is anyone who listens to this, if you've enjoyed Fleabag or Catastrophe, Maisel, like these are shows that are changing comedy for the better. And they were just so on board and so incredible about this process, and they totally got the need for laughing about this year. And I'm so grateful for like the team of people who made this happen.
Yeah. And good for you for bringing on board at least half of the cast that is non-white, because, you know, aside from the fact that they're very funny and talented ladies, did you sort of feel like a roast of 2020 would fall a little flat if you didn't have a strong black voice there?
I don't know if I'd characterize it that way, but I definitely think that representation matters, and something is funny if it represents the broadest swath of humanity and like resonates with the broadest audience possible. Like if people feel like their experiences are reflected back at them. And so out of being genuinely interested in representing other people's voices than my own, as somebody who's very sick of her own voice and constantly checking myself to make sure I feel like other people are included and welcome and enjoying themselves. Like let's make sure that it's not just a special written by and starring people who look like me. Like we have had plenty of that, and on to the next. And like, it takes, it's also just, these are the most talented writers that I know. And these are the most talented comedians. So this was something that came together pretty naturally in the way that it did. And I'm glad that, you know, representation is such a big part of it. Our executive producer, Paige Simpson, is a force behind that as well. I'm super proud of the special and so excited to have worked with this incredible team and incredible group of talent.
Had you worked with all these comedians before this?
No, I had never. I had worked with Patty Harrison before. And then fans of the others, and you know, had like spoken with them, with many of them. And like, we follow each other on Twitter. There were a few like DMs that I slid into to ask to be in this. Which is crazy, but, and apologies, but thank you. and yeah, that's, this was such fantasy wish fulfillment. It's like being slightly into basketball as a kid and like being on your rec team, and then all of a sudden you like organize a fantasy like game at your house with Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen. Like it's crazy that I got to do this.
Yeah, it's a dream team, no doubt about it.
It's a full dream team. It doesn't make any sense.
Now, can you tease a couple of the things that get eulogized on Yearly Departed?
Definitely. Yeah. As you said, so, I mean, it's not all heavy things. This is a comedy show about what we have said goodbye to. And some of them we sort of say good riddance. So casual sex is something that is eulogized. I have been married for 7 years, so it's definitely not something that is a personal thing, but I love that eulogy. It's so funny. And Tiffany Haddish delivers it in this hilarious way. And her ad libs during the table read made it into the show. And she made it her own in this. I mean, Tiffany Haddish is a comedic genius. There's a reason she is Tiffany Haddish. And the way that she just brought it on set in such a like electric. I'm just gonna say, I will sound like a bad writer if I try to describe how like she was electric, but she was. It was the kind of thing where she changed the frequency of the room camera guys and like camera women who were part of the crew, who were like just the most jaded people in the industry, were doubled over. Like, we lost shots. It's like the sound guy fucked it up and like laughed. Like, she is so funny in a way that makes no sense. Yeah. Like, no human should be capable of that. And so that was one of the most exciting experiences I've had. There's a moment that makes it into the BTS where I asked her in the we have the like behind the scenes footage at the end of the show, and we did the social distance. We had three sets. We never filmed all of the women in the same place at the same time.
That was incredible.
I had to shout things at these comedians being like, "You're laughing," because they were not actually in the same room as the person delivering the eulogy. And so I said to Tiffany Haddish, "Okay, now let's get a laugh. Like, let's get a laugh." And, you know, most people would be like, "Ha ha ha ha." I'm not an actress, but they would like do that. Tiffany Haddish cracked herself up to the point of tears for about 4 minutes. And everybody was laughing. It was, you know, it's crazy. It's like Andy Kaufman, Jim Carrey. It's just like this crazy level of comedy that all hail.
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing because I assumed that all of these performers were in the same room together. That's how it looks in the show. But I was amazed to see in those closing credits that that wasn't the case at all. This was truly a socially distanced production.
Yes. And you see me in those closing credits running. I don't know if you could recognize, probably not, but I was like running around with a headset and face mask between the sets and like making like small directions as we went. But the, I'm so grateful that we were able to pull this off safely. Like that was the goal. It's like, we have this idea for a show. Now, how do we shoot it in a pandemic? And the answer to that is this production company, Done and Dusted, who we were so lucky to partner with. These people produced the Emmys in COVID. They did the John Legend, Chrissy Teigen special in COVID. They did the Obama Graduate Together special. Like, these are the Da Vinci's of COVID protocol shooting. And we did it. We pulled it off in a way that everybody was safe. Talent, crew, everyone.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary. You don't notice when you're watching it. No. But in a weird way, it's sort of almost a throwback to the old Dean Martin roasts. I heard that they would do the roasts in Vegas, but a lot of times some of the roasters or the guests didn't want to go to Vegas, so they would just put them on a soundstage at a big table in somewhere in Hollywood at Warner Brothers or something and then edit them in.
Yeah, it's like the moon landing. It's all Hollywood magic.
Exactly. Real quickly, what's the pressure like to do comedy during quarantine? Because you have no live audience giving folks at home that cue when to laugh. So I have to think the bar for comedy must be astronomically high when those jokes have to be able to stand on their own like that.
It is such a credit to the performers that these women, like, the reason that this show works is because of the caliber of talent in front of the camera. Like the people delivering jokes in The Early Departed are at the top of their game, like at the top of their craft. And so, you know, they, like, Sarah Silverman delivering jokes to an empty room is still Sarah Silverman delivering jokes. Yeah. We also, of course, edit in the room so that viewers at home feel like they're at a comedy show. But but on set, you know, when it was her with like a few people in the audience and literal cardboard cutouts of where the actual audience members would be comped in through VFX for her to look at while she was up there, it was still hysterically funny. And it's because these are the greats. The bar was high, but the talent threshold was very high as well. So
yeah, it's a lot of fun. And, you know, what a fantastic way to end this bitch of a year.
Yes.
Once again, Yearly Departed comes out on Amazon December 30th. Bess Kalb, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Ben. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Bess Kalb for coming on the show. Her comedy special, Yearly Departed, is now available on Amazon Prime Video. I also highly recommend her book, Nobody Will Tell You This But Me, A True As Told To Me Story, and follow Bess at BessKalb.com or on Twitter at BessBell. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.